little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
A very hearty welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, and I'm beaming in remotely via Skype in Northern California, as is the other host of this show, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hello. Hello, Bob. Yes, I'm not beaming in, but I am dialed in.
We've got a great guest on this episode, so let's get right to it. But let's take a few minutes here just to tell people how they can get in touch with us and pop up our previously archived versions of Thinking Clearly.
Yes. Well, as I like to say, Bob and I are real people, and we like hearing from you, our real listening audience. You can get a hold of us. We have a Facebook page, Thinking Clearly Radio, where you can find promos for our website. You can also get in touch with us by messaging that page. And then lastly, we are podcasting. You can find our entire archive by going to thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That's LIBSYN.com. Or open up your favorite podcast app, search for a new podcast, add feed, whatever podcast app you're using. There's a lot of them out there these days. And just type in Thinking Clearly and you'll find us in the entire archive. We've been doing this how long now, Bob? I have no idea what day it is. So
it's over 4.5 years.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So time just really flies when you're having fun. And I love doing this show because I've learned so much about things that I didn't know about before. And it's a very engaging topic. And sometimes we take a little time to review our definition of thinking clearly, but we have a great guest with this episode, and we're not going to take that time. But why don't you just go ahead and frame the topic for us, Julie? What are we going to talk about?
We're going to be talking about how group identity functions as a means for understanding the world and one's role within it.
And our guest for this episode of Thinking Clearly is Amber Gaffney. And Dr. Gaffney is an assistant professor of social psychology at Humboldt State University in our neck of the woods, where in addition to her teaching assignments, she heads up the HSU, Humboldt State University Social Identity Lab. And she's especially interested in research that leads to understanding how group identity functions as a means for understanding the world and one's role in it. Professor Gaffney, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you so much for having me, both Bob and Julia. I'm excited to be here.
We are excited to have you here as well.
I've been excited to ask this because, Amber, I just love it that you got your bachelor's degree in psych at Humboldt State University. And then after finishing your PhD in social psychology at Claremont Graduate University, you followed that by some postdoctoral work and some teaching experience, and then returned to HSU.
And I was a professional cyclist as well during that time. I just like to throw that one out there.
Oh, that's one of your true loves. I understand that. I've read about that. When I read about how you did that and was a student at HSU, went on and got your PhD, and then got back as a faculty member, I imagined you this first day walking on as campus as Professor Gaffney. And I wonder how you felt about that. How'd that feel?
So I won't use the potty mouth that my mother blessed me with, but I was really, really excited, and I still am. It as an undergrad at Humboldt State, and just like a little bit of background about me, I grew up in Denny. So for those of you who know like real rural Northern California, I grew up in Denny about an hour and a half from here. And so HSU was my first introduction to higher ed at all. And so it's always held a special place in my heart. And then I did my undergrad here, where there I was lucky enough to work with faculty who encouraged me to get a PhD because I never would have thought to do that. And coming back to this campus was, as an undergrad, I thought like, oh, my dream job is to be a professor at HSU. And when the opportunity arose for me to apply for it, it was like, oh, this might actually happen if I'm lucky and I work hard. So to me, it was amazing to come back and also really neat because some of the folks that were my mentors when I was an undergrad, they are now my colleagues in the department that I work. And that might sound strange, but not at all. They're all incredibly respectful of me and still encouraging of my work and my teaching and all of that. So mostly I just feel incredibly lucky to be here.
Oh, that's great. Well, let's start by painting the big picture about how group identity functions as a means for us to understand the world and our role in it, like we talked about, including the key concepts in social psychology and a light touch on some of the theories in social psychology that frame your research interests in social identity.
So the framework that I work under is a social identity perspective. So this comes from Henri Tajfel's early work in social psychology and then Tajfel and Turner and then the related self-categorization theory. But this whole perspective really considers that our self-concepts, who we are, the self, is comprised, yes, of those things that make us an individual, but how we know ourselves as an individual is impacted crucially by the groups to which we belong. So a lot of the knowledge that we have about the world around us, I mean, you can think, I'm just thinking about a lecture I gave on attitudes today, almost any attitude that you hold is linked to some group membership in some way. And so if you ask somebody, what's your attitude toward abortion, for example, their attitude toward abortion is likely grounded in some political identity or some type of politicized identity. And so they're necessarily people or a group or this big identity representation that are acting on people's thoughts, feelings, and behavior all of the time, whether or not we know it. And in addition to that, we gain a sense of self-esteem from our group. So, you know, your family group, if that's an important group to you, your friendship group, or maybe you're a fan of a football team or a soccer team, or you are an HSU student or an HSU alum like me, when your group does well, you feel good about yourself. So you gain a sense of esteem from that group, which makes groups a crucial component of knowing how people construct their identities and also makes it really important for predicting things like their thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, which is what I'm very interested in.
And how are there other aspects of how we achieve our social identity, not our social identity, but our self-concept or our self-identity other than social groups?
Yeah, absolutely. And so there's within the social identity framework, but there are a bunch of social psychologists. I mean, you can go back to William James on a study of the self, which is still informs the way in which people think of the self today. And I know, given the interests of this show, that's probably an entirely other conversation to talk about James's work. But the framework under which I work look at the self as constructed into two parts, or the self-concept that is the knowledge that we hold about the self into two parts. So the things that we feel make us individuals, that's our personal identity. And then the things that we feel or that we garner from our group memberships. And so that's that aspect that comes from those social identities. And yes, and of course, a lot of the other ways we could go into a broader discussion of the self, but how we know the self is based on how other people interact with us and in an interpersonal manner, the behaviors, the attitudes, the patterns that we observe, and then also our personal experiences. For me specifically, I've studied under the framework to look at how the self is impacted by the group specifically. And we take this a completely collectivistic perspective in terms of understanding human behavior and attitudes and all of that, the sense that you have the individual self, which is impacted by your interpersonal relationships. So your partner, your family, those types of things. And then you go broader than that. You have those friendship groups around you, and then you go broader than that, and you go broader than that until you're at this kind of societal level of understanding of the self.
And are there differences in people in terms of the degree to which they define who they are by these individual means versus the social means?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we could talk about cultural differences, for example. And so, you know, there's a variety, there's a whole bunch of rich research that looks at culturally, some people are, the way in which some people are raised are more likely to view themselves as interconnected or interwoven with others, versus some people are more likely to draw on idiosyncratic aspects of the self to explain basically to explain themselves to themselves. So thinking about what makes them unique and what makes them different is how they feel they know themselves, whereas other people are more likely to draw on their interconnectivity with other people to explain that. However, what we do show in our research experimentally is that, of course, we're dealing with broad, large samples of people, so not this wouldn't be the case for everybody, but statistically, most people and the studies that we run, we can experimentally manipulate the level at which people identify with groups. So there are people. Actually, how I started studying political groups, just because it's really easy to get people to identify with their political group memberships. And, you know, grad student, I want an easy identity to study. And I also thought it was fun. But we can get people to really think about themselves in terms of their group memberships through simple psychological manipulations. So, And that's the case for just about anybody. You just have to be able to identify the group. And of course, as you all know, some groups are just meaningless to other people or to some people. So some of us might have been raised by somebody that me, for example, whose political identity was incredibly important to her. So of course, that's something that I grew up with, but that's not going to be the case with all of my students. So not all of my students' political identities are important to them, or might not be the case for my partner or whatever. But they might draw on identities from other places. So from their family or their sports team or whatever the case is. It's not to say that, you know, every identity that we hold is incredibly important to us. We might be a member, but is it important to us? And then there are those that are crucial for our understanding and interpretation of the world.
What I was thinking about too is it also relates to the idea, and I think you touched on that already, is that some cultures are more collectivist type cultures. And it would seem in those cultures that there would be more identity summed up by the groups in and the culture at large. America has always been more of an individualistic culture, and that dynamic between collectivism and individualism is an important, really important political consideration. We see that now in the COVID, in the pandemic.
Yeah, like willingness to follow mask wearing and things like that. And just as a note, in case any of my colleagues who study culture end up listening to this, that within the United States, we are such a diverse country that individualism and collectivism varies greatly within the context of the United States. So there's that. And one of the interesting things about that is that with people who trend toward that more independent sense of self, we call it. So that's how people know the self concept as what makes them different from other people. They're not explaining themselves with respect to their group memberships consciously. However, it's happening because they have those group memberships that are acting on them, whereas somebody who is more interdependent and sees their lives as more interwoven with other people, you know, those characteristics of collectivism, those folks are going to be more likely to realize that their identities are reliant upon that and more likely to explain the self with respect to those and not think of them as idiosyncratic, the things that make them like different from other people, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I can really see how all these pieces are interconnected and intertwine each other. You know, part of what got our attention was there was a HSU press release regarding some of your recent research exploring these connections between social isolation, which certainly many of us are thinking about more these days, conspiratorial thinking, and resistance to COVID-19 protocols. What have you learned that you can share with us about these relationships between social isolation, conspiratorial thinking, and resistance to COVID protocols?
I've been interested in conspiracy thinking since I was a kid. I've loved watching the X-Files. It was just a thing. And also I grew up in Denny. So I'm familiar with a lot of conspiratorial thinking. But what we did, so part of my training, I look at conceptual self-uncertainty. So that is the extent to which people feel uncertain about who they are and where they're going in their lives. We know from both experimentally and just measuring people's sense of uncertainty about themselves that this predicts and it leads them to identify with groups. So for example, if you are, let's say you consider yourself a Democrat and it's a really strong part of your identity, I make you really uncertain about yourself in some way, you're more likely to rely on that identity as being a Democrat to describe yourself. And you actually increase your level of identification. We've done a work on extremism that suggests, and experimentally we can demonstrate this, and there's other teams of researchers other than myself and my teams that do this as well, is that under uncertainty, people actually desire and crave groups that have really strong, clear-cut norms, because imagine you're uncertain about who you are, where you're going in life. Those are the types of groups that tell you how to think, feel, act, and behave. They allow you to reduce your uncertainty. Now that can go into extremist groups, because extremist groups tend to be groups that have really clear-cut boundaries. You know who's with you, who's against you. And as a result, we have about at least a decade of research, more than that. Sorry, I need to give my advisor and his colleagues credit for that. Oh, way well over a decade of research that demonstrates that when people are uncertain, they find those extremist groups incredibly appealing, because they can use them to reduce a sense of uncertainty. And coming from that perspective, there is some social psychological research on conspiratorial thinking. A lot of it has looked at a way that allows people to gain a sense of control over the world. So if you feel like you don't really understand what's going on, or you don't understand your, you know, position in the world, you may feel as if you're marginalized. Your perception is that you've been marginalized, or your perception is whatever the case is, you're kind of unclear about that. These types of conspiratorial groups can be attractive to people, because you can use it as an explanatory factor. There's a them who's causing it. And if you listen to enough conspiratorial thinking, there's always a them in that type of thinking, right? And with this us versus them type of mentality, this led us and the team of researchers that I work with to think, okay, well, obviously there's this, the conspiratorial groups provide people with a sense of structure, but it could also be that folks, when they're uncertain, would be really interested in them. So we'd started kicking around ideas a while ago for doing some of our kind of classic experiments and uncertainty, but to do it with conspiratorial groups. And then COVID hit. And one of the things that I noticed for myself specifically, and this is going to give you a sense of how privileged I truly am, but I was distraught. I'm like, well, my identity is wrapped up in being a professor. I cannot go into my classes and give my lectures to this room full of students who at least appear to be interested in what I'm saying. I can't go and perform my work. All of, you know, a large part of my identity is wrapped up in this. If I can't enact that identity, who the heck am I, right? Like, who am I without that? And then as I was sitting around, I noticed myself like doing, you know, everyone was doing the doom scrolling in their phones. And I noticed myself doing this, like, I want to believe that there is going to be an end to this real soon. And so I found myself like clicking on not good news sources. And I'm a pretty educated person. I know good news sources. I know bad news sources. And I was thinking, why am I doing this? Why am I entertaining this idea? Why am I saying, oh, maybe it's, why am I trying or wanting to believe that this thing isn't that bad? And I thought, oh, I'm isolated. I haven't gotten to have dinner parties with my friends and see my friends like lovely kids that are my nieces and nephews and do all of these things that allow me to be the person that I am, because I'm isolated right now. And my my research lab, social identity lab, Stephanie Suter, who is now a lecturer at HSU, has been instrumental in this work. So I must give her a shout out. We just started these studies. We first looked, okay, what happens when people feel isolated? Are they more likely to buy into a conspiracy group than if they don't? And we also wanted to see if that isolation predicted self-uncertainty. So we created manipulations in which, I know I'm going to sound like a terrible person, maybe I am, but we created manipulations in which we made people feel isolated from others in a time of COVID, or the positive part of this is one of our manipulations actually increased the connectivity that people felt with important others. And we found that those folks that we put in a condition in which we made them feel isolated, those were the folks who were the most likely to express self-uncertainty. And we also then started creating conspiratorial groups. And we found that particularly those folks who were isolated were more likely to buy into conspiratorial groups surrounding COVID. But one of the things, and where this becomes a part of the first set of studies we did becomes partisan, was that that buy-in was predicted by support for Trump. And so, although I do not think that conspiratorial thinking is a left or right-wing issue, we know that the left experiences it as well. When it comes to COVID conspiracies, the then leader of the United States, who had, 74 million votes in the previous election, was espousing a lot of these conspiracies. And so, or at least some amount of buy-in to those. And so when you have leadership that's expressing that, it then makes sense that support for Trump would predict those isolation effects that we see. And we weren't seeing those in the folks who weren't supporting Trump. Now, of course, the next phase of the research is to change or to shift the conspiratorial group to be one that is not necessarily associated with right-wing conspiracies or not necessarily associated with that, so that we can show that the process exists both on the left and the right. It was just in that series of studies, because we were looking at COVID conspiracy specifically, it was predicted by Trump support. And I always like to throw that out there because I make the same predictions on both sides of the aisle. It's just on this one, we couldn't see it because of what the norms are with conservatives and support for Trump.
Thank you very much, Amber, for sharing experience of yourself feeling like you had lost part of your identity. I'm sure that's happened to other people. It's good to know that even though you study something like psychology, it doesn't make you immune to those kinds of human things that happen to us.
It gives you this sense, also makes you a horrible person to have a conversation with, because the process, I can explain, Amber, how are you feeling? Well, this is the cognitive process. And then it comes out sounding cold. No, but how are you actually feeling? I feel like crap right now. I feel isolated, you know? And so you still get the feeling. You can explain it, but does it make you feel any better? Maybe a little bit. But
I think it's probably instructive to talk a little bit about how folks might identify that they have lost part of their identity in this pandemic. And maybe later on, we can talk about possibly what people can do about that. Is it a sense of anxiety? Is it a sense of loss in a way? I don't know how to describe that. Do you have words for that kind of feeling for people? What should they look out for in themselves and be able to put their finger on what's really happening?
Yeah. And I think, so you're going to see, and I've had so many, I was just in a Zoom meeting at a club that I work with on campus, and we were just talking to some of the members. So the other faculty supervisor and I were talking to some of the members about the isolation and how we all feel and stuff right now. I don't want to tread on, because I'm not a clinician, I'm not a clinical psychologist, so I won't tread into those areas too far because, again, I'll leave that to my colleagues who are trained there. But some of the things that I think that we can notice in ourselves is like, okay, feelings of depression or hopelessness, things like that. Also starting to question your knowledge of yourself. And to me, that was one of the things that I noticed when I, again, doing the scrolling and then starting to go into territory that I don't ordinarily do. And that's saying something for me, because I spend my time on a lot of different news sites so that I understand, or at least hopefully try to understand all the perspectives and how people are consuming information. So I spend a lot of times on these things, but I don't necessarily want to believe those things. And when I found myself wanting to like buy into something and then that desire to, that's where it triggered something for me. And some of the things that we see in some of the qualitative data, when we ask people to write about the things that make them feel isolated or to write about the things that make them uncertain, are really things that, it can go across the gambit, it's like across everything right now, because some people are scared and worried about people getting sick. Some people are worried about their identity. People are worried about their jobs. Like, in this level of worry is, it's beyond just worry at some point. And so we see that, and that is obviously some of the things that are producing that uncertainty. And I'm trying to think. I mean, there's so many. You see that some of the comments in our samples are large samples of Americans, typically, at least in these studies. And you see people who are like, I've turned to drinking. It makes me feel really uncertain about who I am. And as you read this, of course, these are anonymous things that people are writing. It kind of breaks your heart, and you get it too, because all of our worlds have become this. If we're lucky enough to be in a position like I am, again, where I get to look into a Skype call and have a lovely conversation with you, my world still become really small. I can't be like in a studio with you or do those things. And so I think all of those things just kind of contribute to and add up for people. And then you add all of the other issues on top of somebody like me, again, from my house with my blackboard in it, because I have a chalkboard in my house, like pretty cush life for the most part. You add other systemic problems onto this, and people are facing a huge amount of worries. And then, you know, and right now I'm talking about the folks who are actually isolating, and then you see people who aren't isolating, who are going out to, you know, stores or restaurants without masks or hanging out with friends and things like that. And that's not to say that those people aren't experiencing a sense of uncertainty either, because now there's a sense of like, okay, well, probably a good 50% or more of the population thinks that I'm kind of a jackass for doing these things. Like, that's how I think of them. And that's changed their interactions with other people. And it's creating a sense of like, I don't know, you know, friend or foe in these types of situations. Of course, a lot of this is explained by polarization, but it's changed everybody's world. So whether or not people are following the guidelines for distancing and things like that, it's changed literally everybody's world. And I would say it's made us all a bit more uncertain. And sorry, that was a really long response, but.
That's fine. We love long responses here on Thinking Clearly. Straying back into a little bit more of the social psychology research territory, key concept, conceptual uncertainty or self-concept uncertainty. How do you operationalize that? Is it a researcher has to operationalize, which means define it in a way that can be measured? How do you do that?
Yeah, so we have, if we're measuring it, we have a couple of scales that we use, and we ask people questions. How uncertain do you feel right now? Things like, I mean, we can be real straightforward with that. There are other ways that we can ask, and we've talked about cultural differences, so I wouldn't do this. It's not culturally appropriate for everybody to respond to questions like this, but you could ask people a sense of clarity. How clear do you feel about your personality? How clear do you feel about this? And so those people who have less clarity about personality aspects, that would be indicative of their uncertainty. Again, those individual characteristics, asking everybody about that, you brought up collectivism earlier, is inappropriate. So you find other ways to do that. But you also can ask people questions. How, you know, we had my lab worked really hard. So the social identity lab worked really hard on coming up with some COVID specific or isolation specific questions that we ask people. And one of them, and again, you're talking to students who have, they're not in school anymore. They're on their little laptop and sometimes on their phones if they like don't have a laptop, trying to zoom into a call as they're volunteering to do research in my lab, right? So real dedicated group of students, and coming up with questions such as, I feel my social relationships are withering away. And when I read that, I was like, that's powerful. And that just that question alone is powerful, but also it's really sad that we're in a state that that one comes up. So we ask a variety of questions like that. And then to make people feel uncertain, we have a procedure. It's a priming procedure. And we just say, like, hey, Bob, or hey, Julia, I probably wouldn't use their names because I wouldn't know it. But can you please describe to me three things to make you feel uncertain about who you are and where you're going in this life? And so what makes Bob uncertain It can make us all, like, if I write this, I feel uncomfortable. I try this on myself, but I'm a highly uncertain person to begin with. But then all of a sudden I want to join an extremist group. Haha, just kidding. An uncertainty joke. But what makes Bob uncertain, what makes Julia uncertain, and what makes Amber uncertain, that it's going to be different. We might have some overlap given, you know, our small little worlds right now, but the things that really get at the core of all of our uncertainties can be different, right? And then we also I ask people to, in another condition, to make sure that, you know, I have differences between my experimental conditions. Okay, what do you feel confident about? What in your life makes you feel confident, or what in your life makes you feel certain? So those are some of the ways that we operationalize that.
Related to some of that research, if you could share with us what you found out about the effect on Republicans of criticism of President Trump, depending on whether they believe that criticism came from a Democrat or from a Republican source. And we'll start there.
Yeah, awesome. So I love talking leadership. I hope none of the students in either of my classes are listening to me right now. They're like, she's talking about leadership again. So under the research that I do, a large portion of that is leadership. The reason why is that we look at to our leaders as representatives of who our group is, like what our group stands for. They become the face of our group, essentially. And so we look to them for cues for what is normative, what a good group member does, all of that type of thing. So the role of leadership and influence cannot be overstated, right? So we wondered, I'd been thinking about this, actually, my colleague Steve Reicher and I, since 2018, had been kicking this idea around, well, some leaders just, they can fend off anything, like anything. And so you have leaders who have you saw this with Trump over and over, right? After the Access Hollywood tape, after all of these things, you still had his supporters supporting him, and then started noticing. I mean, in this, you saw that with Trump. You saw this with, you know, the first time he was impeached, he actually increased approval ratings during his first impeachment amongst Republicans. That actually was true of Bill Clinton in the 90s as well, when he was impeached. So not just Democrats, and it was Democrats and Republicans in that time increased their approval ratings for Clinton during impeachment. And we thought, but mostly it was Democrats. So those effects were stronger with Democrats. And we thought, well, okay, from a social identity perspective, if you attack somebody's group, you're attacking them as an individual. And so if you see any form of criticism on a leader, so think of a leader of your group. If I'm a Republican and I view Trump as a leader and representative of who I am, he gets an attack, even if it seems like a fair criticism of him, I'm going to think of that as an attack. That's an attack on him. It's an attack on all of us Republicans. And that you're coming at me. You're also coming at me as an individual because he represents who I am. And so we started with this idea. And of course, because I do my research, like we make sure that we do our research on both sides. It's not science if I'm just like looking at an effect on Trump. So we took this idea to Canada as well, because why not? And one of my, I think Lily Cyphers is listening. She's one of my former students, and she's at University of Alberta now. So we have our Canadian connection up there. And we looked at these effects in Liberal Canadians and what happens if there is a criticism of their leader, Justin Trudeau, right? Justin Trudeau appeared in blackface. I think we'd all agree, not cool, not cool, bro. And so that deserves criticism. And what we found is that if we told Liberal Canadians that Justin Trudeau, a critical statement, but a fair critical statement, because he did appear in blackface, a fair critical statement of Justin Trudeau, we told them that that statement came from another Liberal Canadian, or it came from a conservative Canadian. What we found is that to the extent that, or when we told those Liberal Canadians that the source of the criticism was an outgroup member, so a conservative, they viewed that as an attack on Trudeau, an attack on all Liberals, and an attack on them, and it increased their support for Trudeau. We found those same effects during the first impeachment trial of the first impeachment for Trump looking at Republicans. So and this was a survey study. So to the extent that Republicans found the impeachment to be an attack on Trump, they viewed it as an attack on all of them as Republicans, on them as the individual, so the individual participant. And this predicted an increase in support. And then COVID happened, here we are, and we thought, well, okay, leaders demonstrate group norms. So what the next step of this should be is that leaders should, when we criticize a leader or when a leader is criticized, this should actually increase the extent to which followers perform normative behaviors. And so we had the same paradigm where we had a critical response, and I think most of us would agree, a fair critical response of how Trump was handling COVID. And we attributed that critical response to either a Democrat or a Republican. And then what we found is that did indeed increase support for Trump through this idea of that our Republican participants viewed it as an attack on all Republicans. Okay. Then they viewed it as an attack on themselves. But then that also predicted their desire to not perform social distancing behaviors and to not wear a mask. So essentially, when Republicans were thinking, hey, you're attacking my guy, you're attacking Trump, I'm going to perform those behaviors that he is putting forth as normative behaviors, which is, you know, not want to wear a mask, want to go out to gatherings and things like that.
Very good. You know, I got a clear picture of what you're talking about there. And we've lived through these experiences, which is an amazing time to live. You know, a lot of people get depressed by it. I get kind of excited about it because I lived through the 60s and the cultural upheaval in the 60s, but I think this is, in a way, it's more subtle in some ways, but it's also more dramatic and more poignant in moving our culture along. Well, in the intro, I said this is a show about critical thinking and related topics, and we've been talking about a related topic. So let's kind of get this back to a focus about how this affects folks' critical thinking. So give us your perspective on the influence of our social groups, on how we think, feel, and behave, and how we, as critical thinkers, can best take that into account as we attempt to more objectively balance those forces with evidence and logical argument.
Yeah, I think this is an excellent question, because especially in a time where polarization is huge. You know, we are polarized across so many things. Even right now, as a country, we are polarized on following health measures. So it's huge, and it's really easy for us falling on one side or the other side to assume that the other side is stupid, that we don't fall prey to the same processes that they fall prey to, except we do. It looks different because the norms are different on both sides, but the process is the same. And I think understanding that the process is the same, and we can all fall prey to things like conspiracy theory or any of this, you know, those effects of the leader criticism and things like that. We can all fall prey to that. The processes are the same. It just needs to be kind of part of the normative makeup of the group that's promoting it. So I think that I at least hope that having that amount of knowledge gives people a sense of, okay, where we're all humans, we all share these processes. And then I also hope that by having that knowledge and not just simply wiping something away as like, oh, that's stupid. As soon as you do that, you've shut off the conversation and you've shut off your ability to actually know what's going on and to delve in and see what, for me, the psychological mechanism that describes that is the interesting part and allows me to not shut off and just write it off as something that I'm not into or I'm not going to think about because it's not worth thinking about. So I don't know if that directly answers your question, but to me, I think that's a really important and crucial part of critical thinking is understanding that we all fall prey to a lot of these processes that we're talking about specifically right now. And I think knowing that makes us better thinkers, at least I hope so, and makes us more critical of the information that we take or at least question, you know, for me doing the doom scrolling, why am I doing this? Why do I want to believe into something? Like, why? You know, and so having the knowledge that I also, even a person who got my PhD in this stuff, can fall prey to some of these things, I think is important.
On this show, we developed it's kind of a one sheet you called it the basic vetting process for information. And that process starts out with identifying our biases. And our biases come largely, a lot of it, from our social groups. I mean, we're picking up the bias of our group. I call it talking the company line, to be aware that we have those biases and even do a little thinking about, where did I come up with those biases? Why are those biases feel so strong with me? Why do I go into this issue with a belief pretty well formed already? Because critical thinking, we're trying to take a step back and gain a little bit more objectivity and not be weighted down by this, or as heavily influenced by groupthink or the biases that we have individually. So being aware is one way, but one of the things that we're struggling with on this show, or at least I am, to understand is to, because Daniel Kahneman, who was the father of our vulnerabilities and biases and heuristics himself, I've heard him on several podcasts be asked the question, now that you understand these things so well, must make you pretty much immune. And he says, no, it doesn't. So in a way, that's kind of hopeless. If I begin to think that, what are we doing here on thinking clearly if we can't give people some ideas of how they can successfully de-bias themselves?
It's one of the things, and I used to get annoyed when I was, an undergraduate and even a graduate student, when people would be like, I'm not biased. I'm like, yes, you frickin' are. Everybody has biases. But I strongly feel, and this is, Patricia Devine, a social psychologist, has said this multiple times in her research, is that the people who are the least biased are the people who are willing and open to the fact that they are biased. And so that gives you the opportunity to correct it. But most of us don't want to recognize or debate in ourselves when we hold any form of bias. And similarly with those group memberships, I just want to harp back on that a little bit, is to have some amount of understanding of how they filter our worldview. So what we are seeing, and in a time in which reality and facts come under question all the time, we know what is real for me is not necessarily the reality of the other side. And as a psychologist, I always say our perceptions are our reality, right? And so what I am perceiving to be correct and what those people on the other side are perceiving to be correct, we both think we're right. We both know that we hold the truth, right? And the fact that we both think that we're right, and the fact that we both think that we know the real truth and what's going on, and that doesn't agree, that's when I think things get incredibly problematic, and a lot of the problems that we're seeing right now, because there's not agreement on those facts. Now, tools for that, I wish I could tell you I was a more positive psychologist, but I study group processes and intergroup relations. And as a joke, I say that's negative psychology. But I think that, I mean, I always, maybe this is me being optimistic, I always think knowing our biases is a good place to start. And knowing that we hold those is kind of absolutely the best place that we can start, at least in terms of critical thinking, to know that just because I study this, I'm not immune to it. I mean, I was just talking to somebody today who knows me, has known me incredibly well for a long time. He's sitting in the other room right now trying to keep the dogs quiet. And he told me, another part of my research is on persuasion and attitude change. He's like, you are one of the easiest people to manipulate. And I was just getting ready to go to a lecture that I give to my class on attitudes and persuasion, where I teach things like persuasion and things like that. And I'm thinking, this is so ironic, but he's so right. I know the process and I even know when it's happening, but I fall hook, line, and sinker every time to things. So
that's funny. Well, thank you for sharing that. And with this little ray of hope being beamed at us here, Julia's giving me one of those smirks, but
yes. Oh my gosh. We already have a caller.
All right. Great. Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello, caller.
Hi.
Hello.
Yeah. My question is simply, if people's group identification so override their cognitive skills that even if something like, okay, they believe the earth is flat and you're going to say, well, you have to start from the point of view that they believe the Earth's flat. And how do you start a discussion when you know something is totally, I mean, totally not truthful, not, there's not a smidgen of truth in it. That's, you know, that's where I run in. I mean, it's just unbelievable to me that some of the people supporting Trump have no, they're just totally blind. They push aside everything. I mean, I can see, okay, you know, Reagan, all right, what, fine. You know, and different, you know, the Bush guys, you know, but where somebody's behavior goes so far off the scale and it's so false.
That you get an insurrection on the Capitol? Yeah.
It's legitimate. I don't see how you even have a place to start. That's what I'm wondering.
That's a very good question, caller.
Yeah, you're saying people are entitled to their opinions, but they're not entitled to their own facts. And I agree totally with that. Amber, do you have any ideas for us on that?
Yeah, I mean, I can give you the psychological process behind it, but, and like, as a human being, what the caller said, I've been in that situation, and it's really easy for me to come off as like, oh, well, this is how we should talk to people, and this is how we should understand that we all construct our realities filtered through our group memberships. I know that, but I've been in these conversations where and I like to be right. I mean, we all do, but I really like to be right. And so where you end up going into the conversation argumentative and things like that, because you know they're wrong. And what can I tell you about that other than the cognitive process? I'm not sure. If you want to maintain the friendship, do you talk about it? Do you try to find a common ground on something that's not real? Do you try to show them what is reality? Let's hope so. But right now, people's realities are really different from one another. So I think it's an excellent point and an excellent question, and I don't know how to solve it. So
any ideas, Julia?
Right.
No, I
don't. I mean, I would throw your guest speaker's research off, because I grew up with so much insecurity that I don't really, I'm used to a high level of insecurity, so I don't get pushed one way or the other. I mean, like, I really support Obama, but I realize he had a lot of faults, you know, like the drone strikes and his treatment of immigrants and stuff. He's not, you know, better than most presidents, but he's still, I mean, the thing with power, you know, power and money just corrupts absolutely. And none of those people, it's just weird. You can't find a perfect person to be president, that's for sure. So, but anyway, no. I enjoy the talk, and I'm hoping somewhere the research comes where you can have some idea. It sounds like the only way is to make your club, like you're a Democrat or Republican, make your club more attractive than the other club, and pull people away from the other. Criticizing them just seems, from her research, you just drive them deeper into the abyss, engaging in.
But like a positive part that you can take from that is if you can get the criticism to come from within, and the person constructing criticism, because that people are willing to take criticism of their leaders if it comes from us. Why? Because why would you, if we're both Democrats and we both are in support of Barack Obama, for example, and yours, right? We both support him. That a criticism from him coming from the outside is going to appear worse than coming from the inside from one of us, at least according to our research. And we've shown this across multiple studies. And so the idea then could be, okay, well, if you get people who start that message of criticism from within, problematic to people, to leaders who trend autocratic or authoritarian, is they crush all dissent. And that's another line of research we can talk about, because we have data on stuff like that. But problematic with shouldn't beat around the bush. Somebody like Trump is somebody who crushes dissent and goes after all types of dissent. And so it makes dissent coming from the inside incredibly hard, which makes him quite effective at the things that he's trying to do, or did try to do, and is still trying to do.
So I wanted to say it was a great question from the caller. One thing that kind of stuck out to me in considering this question and Amber's responses is there's kind of two things going on. We're talking about how do we talk with a friend and a neighbor who might believe something really outlandish, and how do we handle highly influential leaders who can potentially cause a lot of harm. I mean, the gravity of those situations are a little bit different, and I would think the approaches would be different.
Yeah, it kind of depends on what your goals are. I mean, I think it's always important to think, what are my goals in this conversation? And if you're talking to a person who believes that the earth is flat, then one of the things that I've found where beliefs are so divergent has helped me is to think of some really good questions to ask the person and listen to them. Arguing with them is not going to do any good. Presenting them with facts, usually not going to do any good. But to ask some questions that gets them thinking. I came across a podcast called Down the Rabbit Hole, which is done by a fellow, I forget the guy's name now, but he was a conspiracy theorist at one time, and now he's debunking and helping other people rethink their conspiracy theories. And it's really interesting to listen to. And he talks about people that have gotten away and out of those. Those are very strong groups that people identify with, the flat earthers, because they feel so alienated. Their belief is so marginal that they feel alienated. And there's a lot of cohesion and support that goes on. It's like a support group. So they're almost like a cult, hard to get away from and get out of. But he has, you know, this Down the Rabbit Hole podcast examines stories of people who actually have gotten away from the conspiratorial theory thinking, and sometimes then become debunkers and skeptics and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and there is...
It almost sound like with somebody like Trump, you don't directly confront him, and you just slowly try to maneuver around him and just keep reducing their power and isolating them. And that's the best you can do, is try to get them in the place where they can do the least amount of damage, because it doesn't sound like any kind of direct criticisms or any kind of direct approach only drives more people to him and reinforces the belief system of the people that are following them. So it just seems like you need to figure out a strategy to reduce their power and start isolating them. Other than that, it doesn't seem to be any method. You're not going to reason with them.
Okay, thank you, caller. Go ahead, Amber. You had a thought.
Biden suggested that we stop covering Trump so much that we've had how many years of a full-on news cycle covering Trump, and yet he still is taking up so much of people's time right now. And so that gives him more influence. So the more of the time, the space, the media give him, that we all give him, that allows somebody like him to occupy space, and it gives him the platform that he needs or wants, craves.
Yeah, well, we have just a couple minutes left. Amber, do you have any last-minute thoughts?
I'm trying to think. I'm not sure. I mean, I like answering questions. That's always fun for me. And I appreciate getting the opportunity to speak about my research. Oh, I was, because you were mentioning the Down the Rabbit Hole podcast, there are some researchers who are social psychologists. So Arye Kruglansky is one of them that looks at work on de-radicalization. And mm-hmm. He's looked specifically at extremist groups, so terrorist organizations, terror cells, and looked at ways in which to de-radicalize these people. And some of his longitudinal studies have shown that the methods appear to work. And I suspect it's going to be really similar to the conspiratorial thinking, because as you said, that worldview has isolated folks so much, and they've had necessarily to become ingrained into it. And also problematic with conspiratorial thinking is people who hold on to one conspiracy theory tend to hold on to multiple, even if they conflict with one another. And so you might say, oh, I'll show them that those things aren't consistent. That doesn't necessarily work. So there are methods of like de-radicalization process that I suspect would work with that. So just wanted to throw that out there.
Talking about people and relationships where there's radical differences in opinions, and what that does to actually a relationship, and how do you talk to your family and friends when there's a big gap in beliefs. We are going to have Professor Doherty from University of Minnesota on next month. And so we're going to get into that issue. So Professor Amber Gaffney, I want to thank you very much for being a great guest and sharing your research findings with us and your insights. We're going to link on our Facebook page to your faculty page at Humboldt State University and to the Social Identity Lab. I love that picture of the group on that lab.
Did you see the dog on the picture? When I used to go to,
no.
If you go to my lab webpage, you should see, and I can send it over to you, but one of our pictures of our lab, my dog Jazz, who, if you heard scratching in the back, I apologize.
I saw your dog.
Yeah, he used to go to campus with me on Fridays and would go to lab meetings. So. Yeah.
Folks can find that at hsu-socialidentitylab.com, and it is a very adorable dog. Thank you, Amber, for joining us tonight and for having a cameo with your Jazz.
thank you so much.
And thank you.
Yeah.
I want to thank our engineer, Dennis. I want to give a big thanks to our listeners. They're what keep us going. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studio and is provided courtesy of KMUD, Redwood Community Radio.